This podcast is brought to you by Luca Mele, front-end architecture, team leadership, and technical consulting. Over 16 years of experience turning complex challenges into simple, effective solutions. Learn more at lucamele.ch.
Imagine you're gearing up to build a really complex, multi-step, internationalized app for a client today. Like, you open your terminal, and instead of typing, you know, NPX create React app or spinning up Next.js and just immediately downloading like 200 megabytes of dependencies, you just create a blank HTML file.
Right. It's just one file.
Yeah, exactly. And you just stop there. So today, we're taking a deep dive into a developer who did exactly that and honestly kind of proved why the massive framework ecosystem you probably rely on every single day might actually be holding your team back.
It's a pretty radical departure from what we consider the industry baseline right now. Mm. We're looking at a fascinating case study, along with some broader engineering guidelines, from a front-end developer named Luca Mele.
Yeah, and the context here is super interesting.
It is, yeah. He recently delivered a fully functional wage calculation form. And this wasn't some basic toy app, right? Mm. It had native validation, Tailwind styling. It was internationalized into four different languages. And he did all of this using exactly zero major frameworks.
Which is wild. I mean, yeah. No React runtime, no Redux, no Formic or Zod or whatever.
For nothing.
Just the browser's native APIs and, honestly, a highly disciplined architecture. So our mission for this deep dive is to really explore the mechanics of this.
Yeah.
How does stripping away all those modern framework abstractions actually allow you to build a strictly decoupled component architecture?
Right. Leaning directly on the browser engine itself.
Exactly. Letting the browser solve the problems we usually, you know, pay third-party libraries and bundle size to handle for us.
And by doing that, we're going to see how this approach fundamentally changes team dynamics.
Yeah.
Because it drastically reduces all those dependency liabilities that just absolutely plague modern front-end code bases.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to understand how his code actually works under the hood, we kind of have to look at the architectural philosophy driving it first.
Yeah.
Starting with this concept he calls the rule of least power.
Yeah, the rule of least power is, well, it's an architectural heuristic.
Yeah.
Basically, it dictates that you should always, always use the least powerful language suitable for a given task.
So working your way up from the bottom.
Exactly. If you can solve a UI requirement with pure HTML, you just use HTML. If HTML lacks the capability, okay, then you step up to CSS. Only if CSS fails do you introduce JavaScript.
Right.
And then only when raw JavaScript becomes, you know, utterly unmanageable, mm-hmm. do you reach for a heavy abstraction layer like a framework.
Which completely inverts the modern default, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, today, the default is to boot up a massive state-driven JavaScript application before you even know what the actual business requirements are.
Yeah, developers just reach for React out of pure muscle memory.
Exactly. But he pushes this minimalist philosophy even further, especially with his stance on code duplication. Like, he heavily prioritizes Yaganai. You aren't going to need it over DRY. Don't repeat yourself.
Right. And he makes a very specific, very important distinction here. DRY doesn't mean don't repeat the code. It means don't repeat the logic.
Wait, okay, let me push back on that for a second. Because isn't duplicating code sort of a cardinal sin in programming? Like, right. If I see the same code twice in a code base, my instinct is immediately to abstract it into one shared function.
Sure. That's what we're all taught. But premature abstraction is actually the silent killer of maintainable code bases. Luca argues that if two pieces of code look identical, but they serve entirely different business domains,
okay,
or they consume different backend logic, you absolutely must leave them duplicated.
But what happens when the backend schema changes? Say the user ID format updates. If you haven't abstracted that logic, you now have to hunt down that duplicator code in like six different files, right? Doesn't leaving things duplicated introduce a massive risk of shipping a bug just because a developer missed one of those instances?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, you know, that is actually a tooling problem. It's not an architectural problem.
Oh, interesting. How so?
You don't solve back-end schema changes by creating this massive, tightly coupled God component on the front end. When you try to solve it with abstraction, you create weak cohesion. You solve it with build step tooling, which we'll get into a bit later.
Ah, I see. It's like that classic user profile component trap.
Exactly. That is the perfect example. It always starts out just fetching a user's name. Super simple.
Right, just a name.
But then, to save time and reuse the component, someone wires it up to fetch their recent posts too.
And then maybe their admin permissions.
Yep. And suddenly you have a component that handles auth, content, and display logic all at once. And what happens when the auth API goes down?
the entire UI breaks, even the parts that literally just wanted to display a generic little avatar image.
Exactly. Luca's approach is to keep code exactly where it executes until there is an undeniable one-to-one relationship that absolutely demands a shared abstraction.
So you prioritize explicit separation over syntactic elegance. I like that. But I want to see how that actually translates to the code. Because he built this multi-step wage calculator without React, but he did use a library called Lit, right?
He did, yeah.
But Lit isn't a framework in the traditional sense, is it?
No, not at all. Lit is a tiny, roughly 3 kilobyte library. To understand the difference, you kind of have to look at the mechanism of how they work. React ships a 40 kilobyte runtime because it has to construct and manage an entire virtual DOM in memory.
Right, and it's constantly diffing it against the real DOM on every render cycle to figure out what changed.
Exactly. Lit doesn't do any of that heavy lifting.
It just leverages the browser's native HTML template tags.
Right? Precisely. Lit basically just provides tagged template literals. It evaluates the JavaScript expressions inside your template, remembers exactly which DOM nodes they're bound to natively.
Oh, wow.
And it only updates those exact nodes when the data changes. There is no massive diffing algorithm running in the background. It's just a razor-thin ergonomic wrapper over native web components.
And because he isn't using a massive framework, he's completely dropped the standard React Context API, right?
Yeah.
Or even prop drilling for state management.
Yeah, those are entirely gone.
Instead, he just uses native browser events.
He leans entirely on custom event. When a child form component updates, it just dispatches an event.
Mm-hmm.
But he configures this event with two crucial native properties. Bubble set to true and composed set to true.
Which is such a powerful combination when you think about it. Like, Bubbles ensures the event walks all the way up the DOM tree, mm-hmm. and Composed allows that event to pierce the shadow DOM boundary, right? It just breaks out of the encapsulation of the web component and enters the main document flow.
What's fascinating here is that we have spent the last decade building incredibly complex bespoke state management libraries, Redux, Zustand, whatever, to solve a communication problem the browser actually solved 30 years ago.
Wait, really? 30 years?
Yeah. Think about how a native HTML button works when you click it. It doesn't need a React context provider to tell the parent it was clicked. The event naturally bubbles up the tree. Luca is simply applying that exact same native event-driven architecture to complex form data.
It's like instead of setting up a really complex walkie-talkie network with specific frequencies for every single form field, which is basically what React state is, the input just shouts, "Here's my data," into the room.
That is a great analogy.
It just bubbles up and whoever cares can just listen for it. So simple. The child component fires its data upward, completely agnostic to who is listening. The parent component just attaches a standard event listener.
Exactly. And when it comes to actually collecting that data for submission, he completely bypasses the concept of control components entirely.
Oh, right. Because in a modern framework, you'd usually have a use state hook meticulously tracking every single keystroke of an input field.
Which is incredibly expensive from a performance standpoint. Every single keystroke triggers a JavaScript execution and potentially a full re-render of the component.
Yeah, that always felt so heavy to me. So what does he do instead?
He uses the native form data API. When the user hits submit, he executes basically a single line of JavaScript. He just calls object.fromEntries, formData.entries.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the browser itself serializes all the inputs that have a name attribute and just hands you a perfectly formatted JavaScript object.
Hmm.
It requires 0 bytes of third-party library code.
Okay, but relying on the native DOM for global event bubbling introduces a massive problem, doesn't it? Scoping.
Ah, yes.
Like, if your components are just firing off events wildly across the DOM and you don't have a strict framework enforcing a rigid one-way data flow, how does this not just evolve into a chaotic web of invisible dependencies? If any component can listen to anything, haven't you essentially just built a global variable nightmare?
You're spot on, which is exactly why you have to enforce strict structural boundaries. You can't just let it be the Wild West. And Luca solves this by leveraging native content projection. Specifically, he prioritizes a rule he calls slots over props.
Slots over props. Okay, break that down for me.
In traditional React architecture, if a parent component needs to render a child, you are inherently coupling them together. You pass the content via the children prop, or maybe you use render procs.
Right, the parent has to know about the child's interface.
Exactly, and the child's implementation kind of leaks into the parent. But native web components use slots It's much closer to the concept of inversion of control in back-end services.
Oh, I see. So think of the child component like a USB port on a motherboard.
Yes, perfect.
The child component defines the physical slot, but it has absolutely no idea what you're going to plug into it. A mouse, a keyboard, a hard drive. It just provides the interface.
Right. And the parent component is the device you're plugging in. It just drops itself into the slot, completely ignorant of how the motherboard routes the data internally.
That is such a clean mechanism.
It really is. And Luca enforces a strict rule in his architecture based on this. The child component is a provider.
Meaning
the parent always imports the child. The parent handles the layout, so your CSS grid, your flex box, the margins, all the visual spacing, while the child handles the isolated functional logic.
So if you have a multi-step wizard, the wizard component itself doesn't actually know anything about wage calculations or user profiles.
Nothing at all.
It just knows how to transition between step one and step two, and it provides a slot for the current step's content.
Yes, and to handle logic that actually does need to be shared across multiple UIs, he utilizes what he calls abstract components. But he enforces a really brilliant defensive pattern here. The proxy pattern.
Oh, right. I remember reading about this. He creates a private abstract component to house all that messy 80% of shared logic, right? But you aren't allowed to import it directly anywhere else in the app.
Exactly. You wrap it in what he calls an expert component. The expert component acts as a facade. It imports the private abstract logic internally, and then it exposes a very strictly typed, narrow API to the rest of the application.
So if a junior developer comes in, or let's be honest, a senior developer in a rush.
Yeah, exactly.
And they try to abuse the abstract component by passing in some weird prop just to solve a one-off UI bug, they literally can't. The expert component proxy physically prevents them from accessing the underlying abstraction directly.
It creates a hard boundary.
So if I'm understanding this right, does this mean you could theoretically rip out the entire visual UI of his SEP wizard, drop in a completely new design system, and the actual underlying data logic wouldn't have to change at all?
Absolutely. That is the definition of true composition over inheritance, but executed natively right in the browser.
Wow.
You have dumb visual components focused entirely on presentation and smart components focused entirely on data encapsulation, and they never inappropriately intertwine.
Okay, the architecture is undeniably clean. But let's talk about the elephant in the room, validation. Because forms are notoriously brutal when it comes to validation.
Oh, for sure. They can be a nightmare.
Right. Making sure emails are actually valid, checking number ranges, handling custom rejects patterns, and then, crucially, announcing all of those errors cleanly to screen readers. Usually that's where you just throw your hands up and say, okay, I absolutely have to drop in Zod or yep, here. How do you handle complex validation across encapsulated Shadow DOM boundaries natively?
Well, you leverage the browser's built-in constraint validation API.
Wait, the browser can just do all that natively?
Yes. The browser engine, which, by the way, is written in highly optimized C++N, not JavaScript, already knows how to validate forms. When you add HTML attributes like required, min, max, or pattern to an input tag, you aren't just giving the browser a polite suggestion.
You're invoking a native validation engine.
Exactly. The browser naturally intercepts the submission event. It evaluates all the constraints. And most importantly, it handles the operating system level accessibility announcements entirely for free.
Okay, but what about that classic UX issue where a form just starts yelling at the user with red text before they've even touched an input? How does he solve that without a state manager?
He implements a CSS-only dirty state pattern.
Yeah.
He just toggles a single CSS class on the parent form after the very first interaction.
So no complex JS state machines tracking focus and blur events for every single field?
None.
Okay.
The CSS utilizing the native invalid pseudo class.
That is so lightweight. But wait, the real technical hurdle in his rage calculator case study is validating the slotted content, right? Inside the multi-step wizard?
Yes, this is where it gets tricky. Because the inputs physically live in the light DOM, the parent document, but they are being visually projected into the child wizard's shadow DOM.
Right. So the wizard child component has to somehow intercept the next step click, validate inputs it doesn't actually own, and block the transition if they are invalid.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Luca uses a native DOM method called slot.assignedElements.
Oh, I love this trick.
It is so clever. It allows the child component to basically reach through the slot, grab references to the actual input elements living in the parent's light DOM, and imperatively call the browser's native check validity function on them.
So it's literally just asking the browser's C++ engine, hey, are these inputs valid based on their HTML attributes?
Exactly.
But wait, if they are invalid, how does he show the error? Because if the user is on step one and there's a hidden error on step two, the browser can't draw an error tooltip on a hidden element, right?
Right.
Won't the native report validity function just fail silently?
It would. But the mechanism he uses to solve this is incredibly elegant. If the validation fails, Luca's JavaScript temporarily removes the hidden attribute from all the steps in the wizard.
Wait, so for a fraction of a millisecond, the entire form just unspools?
It renders the entire thing to the DOM, yes.
Oh.
Right. And then, while it's fully rendered, he calls report validity. The browser calculates the absolute screen coordinates of the invalid input and draws the native OS level error tooltip pointing directly at it. And then instantly, his script reapplies the hidden attribute to the other steps.
So the browser does all the heavy lifting of calculating layout and drawing the accessible tooltip, and the user's eye can't even perceive that the UI temporarily unrolled itself.
Exactly. It happens too fast to see.
That's a brilliant manipulation of the platform, and you get better, deeply integrated accessibility than you ever could writing custom div tooltips in React.
It really showcases a deep mastery of the platform's execution lifecycle. You just let the browser handle the complex layout calculations, and you just orchestrate the state.
So we've walked through the mechanics, we've eliminated the massive runtime, we've dropped the global state managers, and we've tossed out the heavy validation libraries. But earlier I asked you about the consequences of duplicating code, and you mentioned it was a tooling problem. Let's look at the actual human element of this architecture, because Luca actually runs front-end teams.
Right, he's a technical leader.
So how does this native-first approach impact the day-to-day operations of an engineering team?
You measure that impact by looking at the dependency tree. Luca's entire wage calculator application operates on exactly 5 dependencies.
5 total.
Lit for the component ergonomics, i18 Next for the 4 language translations, Tailwind for styling, Express for the back-end mock, Invite for the build tooling.
That's insane. Contrast that with a standard enterprise React application. You are pulling in React, React DOM, React Router, Redux or Zustan, Formic, Zod, styled components. I mean, you easily hit 15 to 20 massive dependencies, pulling in thousands of subdependencies before you've written a single line of actual business logic.
And in a team environment, every single package in your package.json is a persistent liability.
Right, because it has its own release cycle.
It introduces breaking changes that require weeks of refactoring. It expands your security surface area, requiring constant monitoring for vulnerabilities in packages you didn't even know you relied on. Luca's engineering guidelines are relentlessly focused on mitigating those liabilities.
Which brings us perfectly back to your answer about my duplicated logic concern earlier. If we are duplicating UI logic across the app to maintain decoupling, how does his team ensure they don't just ship bugs when the backend API changes?
Through automated OpenAPI type generation. He integrates this directly into the CI/CD pipeline.
Okay, explain the mechanism there. How does that protect the front-end developers?
So the back-end team maintains a Swagger or OpenAPI specification document that defines exactly what their API endpoints expect in return, right? During the front-end build step, a script parses that document and automatically generates strict TypeScript interfaces.
Ah, I see.
If the back-end team renames a property, say, from user underscore ed to camel case user ed, the front-end build instantly fails.
It catches the mismatch at compile time, completely neutralizing the risk of the duplicated logic breaking silently in production. The TypeScript compiler literally points the developer to the exact 6 files they need to update.
Exactly. And he combines this with a really strict rule regarding adapters. Developers are strictly forbidden from using the native fetch API directly inside a component.
Oh, interesting. So every network request must pass through an adapter layer.
Every single one.
So if the external API radically changes its structure, or I don't know, you swap out a third-party service entirely, your UI components don't care at all. You just update the parse and logic inside the adapter function once, and the components continue receiving the exact data shape they expect.
It perfectly isolates external volatility from your core UI logic. And he brings this exact same pragmatism to their testing strategy, heavily prioritizing UI tests.
Right, because unit testing every tiny function can get pretty tedious.
Yes. Rather than getting bogged down writing exhaustive unit tests for every isolated helper function, he mandates tools like Playwright.
Uh-huh.
The mechanism here is to spin up a headless browser, Configure a mock server to intercept the network requests so you aren't subject to back-end flakiness.
Now that's smart.
And then programmatically interact with the UI exactly how a real user would.
You test the actual DOM output, you click the buttons, you fill the inputs, and you verify the visual state. It provides infinitely higher confidence that the application actually works than testing a pure function in total isolation.
But, you know, this raises an important question, and it's a nuance Luca explicitly addresses in his writing. Are we saying the era of React is over?
Yeah, that's the big question. Like, if you have an engineering team that has spent 5 years mastering React and they can spin up complex features rapidly, should you really force them to just burn it all down and rewrite in native web components? Because it sounds like a recipe for a massive loss of velocity.
Exactly. And Luca is very clear. This is not a silver bullet that replaces React for everything. If you are building an application that requires massive, highly concurrent, client-side, state-like, say, a collaborative Figma-style editor or a real-time crypto trading dashboard, the virtual DOM and heavy framework abstractions are still incredibly powerful tools.
Right. You still need them for that level of complexity.
But his argument is that for the vast majority of the web e-commerce flows, standard data dashboards, B2B CRUD applications, multi-step forms, we are defaulting to tools that were engineered for edge case complexity.
We're bringing a sledgehammer to drive in a thumbtack.
Exactly. Technical leadership isn't about adopting the trendiest ecosystem. It's about establishing constraints that allow your team to consistently ship resilient software. You achieve that by minimizing the runtime overhead you ship to the user and ruthlessly minimizing the third-party liabilities your team has to maintain.
So, let's look at the paradigm shift we've explored today. We started by challenging the modern impulse to abstract early, seeing how prioritizing UAGN over DIY actually protects components from weak cohesion.
Right.
We looked at the mechanics of lit and native custom event bubbling, proving you can build reactive architectures without a virtual DOM at all. We saw how native slots act as strict hardware interfaces for truly decoupled design. And man, we explored how leveraging the browser's C++ constraint validation API just entirely eliminates the need for massive validation libraries.
It fundamentally reshapes how you view the browser. It's no longer just a document viewer you have to hack around. It is a highly capable application engine in its own right.
So what does this all mean for you?
Well, for the last 10 years, the front-end developer community has poured billions of dollars into creating an incredibly dense layer of middleware. We built virtual DOMs because manipulating the real DOM was prohibitively slow. We built massive state managers because tracking form data natively was a nightmare.
It used to be terrible, yeah.
But while we were distracted maintaining our massive node modules folders, the browser engine itself quietly caught up. The native platform now offers the performance and the primitives that we originally needed frameworks to provide. So the real question is, are the massive frameworks we view as modern development actually becoming legacy technical debt without us even realizing it?
That is a phenomenal question to leave on. The next time you sit down to architect a new feature, maybe pause before typing npm install, look at the problem and ask yourself, is this really something I need to download 50,000 lines of JavaScript to solve? Or did the browser already solve this 10 years ago? Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Open up your code base this week, look at your architecture, and see just how much you might be able to strip away.